Welcome to this two-episode series of Moneyball Medicine on AI, machine learning, and analytics focused on how we get these technologies working in the provider setting. This special series was recorded as part of the AI World Conference produced by Cambridge Innovation Institute this last December in Boston, Massachusetts. I am your host, Harry Glorikian. In this series, I will interview two of the speakers from the event and we will hear their experiences. We will dive into the challenges and opportunities they're facing, looking at how we implement AI and machine learning into clinical practice. Welcome to Moneyball Medicine. My next guest has said that AI is not the solution and that apps are not the solution, but that more effective care workflows that apps and algorithms enable are the solution. Today, we will be discussing how integrating algorithmic techniques into clinical care and decision-making can really work. My next guest is the Executive Director of Information Technology at Partners Healthcare Personalized Medicine, Samuel or Sandy Aronson. His team develops IT infrastructure required to support the evolution and practice of genetic-based personalized medicine in both patient-facing and laboratory settings. The system ecosystem the team maintains enables a real-time continuous learning process. This process harnesses clinical testing workflows to advance knowledge surrounding genetic variation and deliver this knowledge in near real-time to clinicians treating patients. Mr. Aronson is one of the founders of Gene Insight. He co-chairs the Displaying and Integrating Genetic Information through the EHR, initially organized under the Institute of Medicine, now part of the FHIR Foundation. Mr. Aronson also co-chairs the Emerge Network EHR Integration Working Group and serves on the Scientific Advisory Board for the Clinical Pharmacogenomics Implementation Consortium. Mr. Aronson holds a master's in organizational behavior and a bachelor's in computer science from Stanford University. He also received a master's in biology from Harvard Extension School. Sandy, welcome to Moneyball Medicine.
Thanks for having me, Harry.
So, Sandy, we've known each other, actually. I was thinking about it for quite some time now. I remember when this was sort of first, you know, an idea back when I was even talking to Dr. Rollins. But can you tell me something or tell us something about your group and how it's evolved, say, over the last 5 years?
Sure. So my group, actually going back a little bit further, is actually a little over 15 years old. We came in because Partners Healthcare recognized that genetics and genomics had the potential to fundamentally transform the way we care for patients. But at the time, Partners didn't know how quickly that transformation would happen, but it knew that really significant infrastructure would need to be built and that would take time. And they wanted to get started on it, not just from a kind of laboratory infrastructure perspective, but also from an IT infrastructure perspective. So we started building infrastructure, again, a little over 15 years ago. The very, very beginning was focused on wet lab infrastructure. But within the first year, we realized that sort of the management of clinical interpretation of genetic data was where the real challenge was. So we started working on that. And as you mentioned, we built, in addition to, you know, systems to integrate the kind of the diverse types of instruments that are involved in genetic testing. Also a system or a suite of applications called Gene Insight that really focused on managing the report generation process, the knowledge management surrounding specific variants that are found in patients, and making sure that if new information emerged on one of those variants, you know, we had a mechanism for integrating with the EHR when possible and delivering that new information back to clinicians. So if that information for patients, you know, where variants had previously been found, if that new information could materially improve their care. So we took that infrastructure, and it really did create, as you said, an instance of a true continuous learning environment that was IT mediated, not like machine learning. It was manually, you know, facilitated learning, but it learned as a result of clinical transactions through the system. So we recognize that its ability to evolve would be limited based on our own internal clinical genomic testing volume. So we registered it as a medical device. We began distributing it outside of partners, and we networked the different instances together so that labs could learn from each other. And then a little over 2.5 years ago, we sold this infrastructure to Sunquest. And the reason we did that was because we wanted to make sure that, you know, Sunquest, I believe, has the largest number of, or at least at the time had the largest number of installations in pathology departments. And we, you know, we're fundamentally not a healthcare software, you know, distributor. And we wanted to make sure that the system could grow to the greatest extent possible. After that sale, the vast majority of my team went to Sunquest, and the team that stayed behind, there were four of us, and we started looking at what we do next. And what we wound up focusing on was really this problem of how do you get innovation, exactly what you were saying at the beginning, Harry. As you know, the world is starting to shift as these digital technologies really enable us to think about care pathways differently. You know, how do you interject, how do you enable clinicians to truly in the real world take advantage of those technologies and shift their clinical process flows in ways that'll be more effective?
Well, you've said before that, you know, the system is primed for radical disruption. And so when you say that, what do you mean by that? Is that a AI machine learning sort of revolution? Is that, how the payment system is working or where care will be provided? What is it when you look at it from the lens you're looking at? What does the radical disruption mean to you?
Yeah, so the thing that I feel I've learned over the last 2.5 years is that I think the most profound thing that's happening is what I'd call enhanced care, algorithmically enhanced care, where that can be a machine learning algorithm, but it certainly doesn't have to be. But it's some type of algorithm that may operate on a new type of data that wasn't previously available or may not, but that assists decision-making in some way. And when we started this process, we felt that the change that we were going to, you know, be seeking to bring about was interjecting these capabilities kind of surgically into clinical processes to give clinicians the ability to use new types of data, new algorithms to improve their decision making. But what we've actually found is, while that's useful and I think, you know, a very meaningful thing to do, there's a broader opportunity, which is once you have these capabilities, you can actually look at how the clinical process itself could be redesigned around them. And once you start doing that, then everything comes, you know, onto the table. You know, the way you engage with patients, the frequency with which you engage with patients. I do believe, as you mentioned, Harry, that payment models could wind up shifting on this. It could enable sort of new ways for new players to take risk, and by taking risk, enable even more significant changes in clinical processes. So like algorithmic care is the fulcrum, and it enables you to pivot, you know, in ways that go beyond just what the algorithm itself is doing.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say, you know, I was just also speaking to Dr. Patel, who was also at the same meeting we were at, and we were, because he's not just a physician, he's an engineer, so slightly, interesting background on that. But we were talking about how, is it the implementation of the machine learning or AI into the existing workflow that has the power, or is it rethinking the workflow to really maximize the benefit of the machine learning or AI system? And what I've seen in other industries is the latter, not the former. And what you just said plays right into that is, how are we going to make that shift? How are you working with clinicians right now to implement that sort of workflow shift, mindset shift, educational understanding at partners?
Yeah. So I do believe that it's the latter. I think that it's like these complete workflow redefinitions that, that have the most power to, improve things. I think that, but at the same time, that said, it is a continuum, right? So any intervention that you do that works is going to cause people to do things differently. And you can look at that as a workflow change. It's a question of sort of how much of the workflow is changing. So in terms of some specific examples, one of the amazing, privileges of working where I work is that you have these amazing clinicians who come up with these incredible ideas. It's not me or my team that comes up with, the transformations that are possible. We get to work with clinicians who, who have that idea, who typically have started to work on the new workflow and then the types of IT support that we can bring to the table can enable them to really accelerate the bringing that idea to fruition and having it affect as many patients as possible. So some specific examples, if we go with a very focused example, we have we've built a solution that's deployed now. We're gathering data on it that enables a blood bank technician to select the best unit of platelets for an individual patient based on the HLA profiles of donors who have platelet donors who have units of platelets in inventory and the platelet recipient, where previously the way that this process worked is about 15% of the time when we gave platelets to bone marrow transplant patients, the bone marrow transplant patients' white blood cells would, immediately destroy the platelets because of a lack of an HLA match between the donor and the recipient, which, there's an economic cost to that, there's a clinical cost to that, there's human cost to that. And it would often take, 3 to 7 tries before we recognize that the patient we were dealing with was particularly hard to match and we'd have to do something special. Now what we do is by marshaling data in a whole bunch of different systems, we actually, at Brigham and Women's Hospital, the technician goes to take a unit out of inventory, and as opposed to just taking the oldest unit, they can take the best unit for that patient. And we think that this is going to have, a really positive effect on sort of the whole process of administering platelets to bone marrow transplant patients.
So it's interesting. You say that it's the person doing the work, but it's interesting that I look at it and say, well, it's the system that is sub-selecting based on data and offering it up to them. They may have a choice of like 3 or 4, but it's offering those 3 or 4 as opposed to the potential hundreds or thousands that were a different option. So it's it's a machine-human interaction that I think that that's sort of interesting to get to a better level of care.
Yeah, so what we're doing is, and I should say these units of platelets they're precious. So you don't necessarily have, you have a limited number of them in inventory at any given time. And what the system does, it does a lot of things in terms of giving them information on, you know, how hard this patient appears to be to match, you know, historical platelet values for the patient, things like that.
So, Sandy, you've said in the past that interjecting new types of data is critical. So, how do you inject new types of data and algorithmic support into care delivery process so that you can, I don't know, help improve, you know, clinical decision making, whether it's from the physician, whether it's from a nurse or anybody sort of managing that patient?
Yeah, so all of this comes down to really understanding what the current workflow is and what the goal is. You know, how are we attempting to perturb the workflow so that either a better decision is made or a better form of care is delivered, or care is delivered in a way that's more efficient for both the system and the patient. So it's really understanding, you know, the change that we're trying to make, and then working with the clinicians to identify what the best way is to really work through iteratively, usually, what type of IT support can be used as an intervention to get us to the new, more powerful workflow. And then, you know, as you're figuring that out at the high level, then there's always, you know, a huge amount of work associated with data access, with UI design, with information security, often with, you know, figuring out how you represent algorithms robustly, and, you know, and maintain them over time. There's a whole bunch that goes in behind the scenes, but at the highest level, it's that partnership between the team involved in the patient's clinical care and the IT team that brings it about.
So, just out of curiosity, when you say interjecting new types of data, what would be some new types of data? I mean, I keep thinking about, you know, papers like Joel Dudley wrote in June, and I keep referring back to this over, you know, again on this podcast, but, you know, bringing in multiple types of data that then point us to what could be the driver of a disease or something. And when you say new types of data, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I was speaking a little bit ago about this application that we built for platelet management. And the central, you know, new type of data, and I do that in air quotes, is the HLA values for the patient and the donors, which, you know, we've always tested the patients. We've always generated HLA profiles for the bone marrow recipients because we need to in order to match the bone marrow. And there's actually a relatively limited number of incredibly altruistic people who come in to, you know, sit for the 2 hours while their blood is circulated outside of their body to donate platelets that make the bone marrow transplants possible. So because that's a relatively small number of people, you can type them as well. And then once you have those two types, then you bring them together in an algorithmic way. So it was really the platelet management use case was really about HLA data. A great deal of our work today is with Callum McRae's team at BWH Cardiology Innovation that really focuses on you know, completely changing the way that we manage lipids, hypertension, and heart failure. And that work starts with the really looking at the process redesign itself, which is made possible by instantiating algorithms or guidelines into algorithms, and then putting in place a whole process for, you know, for leveraging them to improve care. But once you have that framework for managing a specific disease, then you can look at how you bring in orthogonal data and how you manage that. So that started for us with things like, you know, integrating home blood pressure cuff data into the process. But you can easily see how many additional forms of data will be useful. One of the ones that seems most compelling to me is, you know, the geospatial data that can be gathered through watches, et cetera. And, you know, and seeing how it seems likely that there would be signal there that would help with understanding how, you know, heart disease progresses. So, and then there's, you know, there's other types of data in other areas that is potentially useful.
Yeah, I mean, there's some amazing things that are coming up when you look at the input of the data, but then the ability to actually crunch that data. And when I mean crunch, it's, you know, call it AI machine learning, call it whatever name you like, plus all the processing power and the ability to store much cheaper and easier than we ever have before, and starting to see some incredibly interesting things that we never were able to see before, which I find fascinating. I mean, how do you see care changing based on your prediction of the future? How do you see the business model itself being, you know, affected by this, and where you and I sit from these technologies and these data sources?
Yeah, it's interesting. And a bunch of what I'm about to say, I learned from really working with Callum McRae and his team. But I think what's going on here is for certain classes of patients, there are guidelines which, when you implement them robustly, you know, improves that patient's, you know, those patients' outcomes. And so there's a need, but those guidelines are often difficult to implement in the setting of modern healthcare because of the level of interaction that's required between the patient and the person administering their care. And that creates a world where if you can interject new capabilities for particularly, you know, interactions based on, you know, phone and text with, you know, not only clinicians, but also people like patient navigators who can really work closely with patients to optimize their care. You know, when you start putting in place these capabilities, they're, you know, fundamentally you can think of these guidelines as algorithms that can get better over time. In order to robustly use an algorithm in the course of modern healthcare, you have to robustly obtain the data that the algorithm operates on. So in order to put all of this into action, you need to transition to a new process and support that process that enables you to robustly collect this data over time. Once you're robustly collecting that data, then you've got new types of opportunities for machine learning based on data that's potentially has more signal in it than the data that was collected before you instituted the new process. It also enables you to under, you know, very careful, using very careful, you know, interventions, add new types of data to the data being collected and see whether it's potentially helpful or not. So there's really a continuous improvement cycle that can be set up here, where essentially by implementing the algorithms, you have to standardize data collection and improve data collection. And then as a result of that, you gain the data required to continuously improve the algorithms, as well as assess, you know, whether new forms of data as they come in online are actually helpful or not, and integrate those new forms of data if they are.
So it sounds like it's interesting, right? I mean, I think if you go back in time, there was a lot of sort of trial and error that went on to, you know, develop like best practice. But now we're going to, it seems like a new era of trial and error because of the power that these capabilities now bring to the table to enter that next phase of continuous process improvement. I mean, I know with healthcare, that's everybody goes not berserk, but doesn't like that necessarily because they want something absolutely proven. But it seems that we're in that era of, you know, you just handed somebody, you know, these supercomputers. You gotta try them out. You gotta see, you know, what could completely change the outcome for these patients. And I think these sensors that, you know, we're seeing deployed in the field, I mean, just looking at, you know, the Apple Watch on my arm, is it's got to be a complete new paradigm to how care will be managed, and you know, patients can be actually influenced right in their own home, as opposed to that one time a year when they come in and see the physician.
Right. So in today's world, there is a great deal of trial and error in medicine, right? And in fact, some of these guidelines actually, in a way, call for that. So they call for, you know, starting with an initial drug, seeing whether it has the desired effect. If it doesn't have the desired effect, you know, titrating up the dose of that drug until, you know, you hit side effects or you hit the desired effect. You hit side effects, then you go to the next drug, or you try a combination of drugs, or you titrate back. So there is, maybe trial and error is the wrong way to describe it, but there's an iterative process associated with arriving at the best treatment for the patient. And so that's a process that, you know, we want to make sure is as efficient as possible. You just look at it in terms of instituting the guideline, you want to perform that optimization as quickly as possible, because we know that's good for patients, that's good for mortality. So
yeah, I guess when I say that, I mean, I almost feel like this is when I would, you know, and I don't do this anymore, is sort of, you know, work on my engine in my car when I was younger, is, you know, you now you've got the ability to see this constant stream of data coming from multiple sources. And I'm not going to say you can fine tune it in real time, but you almost feel like you can start to head in that direction.
Yeah. So, right. So you've got a couple of different modes here. You know, one mode is, you know, really trying to figure out, are techs set at 9 a.m. more effective than techs set at 10 a.m. in terms of hitting, you know, a particular outcome. So understanding, sort of fine tuning, you know, that aspect of the process. You've got another mode where, you know, looking at data that you don't know whether it's relevant or not, but is associated with this process, that, you know, you that you obtain, you know, in concert with the patient, you know, with a fully informed patient, to try to ascertain whether there's signal in this data in terms of it being able to, you know, help the care delivery process, sort of collecting data in parallel with the existing process. And then, you know, you progress to where you actually want to do something that looks like a trial, and you want to try, you know, things two different ways prospectively and see which way works better. And one of the nice things about the infrastructure that's being created is it should make those trials much, much more efficient to do than they can be done today.
So if you had to, like, I don't know, I don't want to say pick your pet peeves or think about the impediments or your biggest challenges in what you're trying to do and then the implementation of it. For those people are, you know, who are listening and want to hear what really are the things they need to focus on when either getting the information or getting the output to the right people, what would they be? What would be the key factors?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I guess it depends on the context. So if the question is, you know, you're operating within, if the context is you're operating within, you know, an academic medical center, and your goal is to, you know, work with a clinician who both has a source of funding and has a strong idea for how they want to perturb their process flow. So on a high level, the project is, you know, the project objectives are well-defined, the funding's well-defined. Then the biggest challenges become things that are highly related to the technical process. So obtaining the data winds up being, you know, a significant part of the project. Actually doing the user interface design, designing the new workflow iteratively, also a big part of the project. And, you know, where perhaps, and of course, you know, quality assurance being critical, where one of the biggest risks that you face is that you'll build something that maybe even, you know, tests well, but doesn't truly get adopted in a way that improves care. So to protect against that, you wind up needing to go deep into process design with the clinicians and really focus in that way. But that's if your context is, you know, within the AMC, within a defined project. If your context is sort of pre that, where you have an idea how to fundamentally transform a process, but you don't have funding yet, and, you know, and this isn't an internal sort of, you know, quality process improvement project. This is something that's, you know, that you're going to try to convince people to adopt in, you know, in the broader world. I think then the biggest challenge becomes understanding how this will fit with how the change that you want to institute will fit with reimbursement models once it has been proven to have the impact that you're looking for it to have, and whether you actually, in order to institute the change that you're going after, whether you actually have to fundamentally introduce an entirely new reimbursement or risk management model, or whether you can fit within the current economic system.
Yeah, it's in some ways quite daunting, depending on and how you're going to put one of these things. Sometimes I always think that doing it a completely different way is always easier, but you're living within the context of the institution that you're in, which is what many of the people that we saw at the conference are sort of living in, is how to make change and implement these capabilities in the institutions that they're working in, which is always not easy because there's an existing status quo and a process to doing it.
Yeah. Now that said, when we work internally, our intention is to open source our work and to distribute it as broadly as we can. The other thing that it is likely that we will do is, seek to use these capabilities to enable ourselves to provide care to more people than we can currently provide care to. So our ultimate goal is for the infrastructure we're building to have a much broader, much more positive impact than we could achieve just through, internal use for our existing patient population. But that said, I do think it is easy to underestimate the resources and capabilities required to affect these transformations. A lot of times folks feel that if they could just train this machine learning model, or if they could just build this app, that's going to affect the change that they're looking for. And the reality is that to affect change, you have to change what people are doing on the ground. You have to be affecting, clinical processes. And once you're doing that, you're into something that I think is much larger in scope than folks realize. And therefore, it does favor actors who can put a lot of resources behind what they're trying to do. It becomes harder for a smaller actor to actually be able, even if they have an awesome idea, to really be able to get it off the ground.
Well, we were, when I was talking to Dr. Patel, he was saying that, we need to retrain physicians and think about almost like a process re-engineering course that everybody needs to take, so that it's much easier to implement these things in the future.
Yeah, and I do think, in my view, this is going to happen process by process. We're going to learn things. We're going to become better and better as time goes on, but I do think that this is an exercise. This isn't like there's some meta, high level like application that we're going to build that's going to transform all of medicine. This is ultimately taking a look at every clinical process and saying, if this clinical process was rebuilt today in the context of all of the digital and algorithmic capabilities that we have, how would we rebuild it? And how much better would that process be than what we're using now? And if the answer is a lot, then the question becomes, what types of intervention, what types of IT support or other support is needed in order to leverage, that old process, over to the new improved process?
Yeah, I think that there's going to be the groups that do and survive and or thrive in the future. And I think there's the ones that either don't or don't do it as swiftly. And that I'm not sure where it leaves a system like that, based on where we're headed.
I 100% agree. I think that it's exactly like, we were looking at 15 years ago with genetics and genomics. We know that these kinds of capabilities are going to be incredibly disruptive in a good way. But we don't know when, this fundamental shift begins to happen in mass. But we do, but at the same time, we do know that there's a whole new infrastructure that needs to be built to enable all of this. And that infrastructure is going to take time to build. So if you wait too long, you can wind up really behind the eight ball here, you know, where it's the type of thing where it takes time to establish support for these new processes. So you can't react on a dime. It's just not possible to react on a dime. So you have to, you know, figure out where you proactively want to make your bets, where you can make the most difference. And, you know, I don't know that reactive works in this model.
No, you know, I don't think so. I think that's going to be almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, let's hope that most of these, the institutions, you know, at least in this country, if not worldwide, sort of make the proactive changes they need to make. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I'm sure the listeners got a lot out of the wisdom that you've accumulated over all these years of trying to make all these things happen. And I wish you great success going forward.
Thanks, Harry. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care.
And that's it for this episode. If you enjoyed Moneyball Medicine, please head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. It is greatly appreciated. Hope you join us next time. Until then, farewell.